Welcome to Good Moms on Paper, a podcast from Annie Hartnett, Tessa Fontaine, and Ellen O'Connell Whittet, three writers who are also mothers of young children. We're here to discuss writing and parenting problems, which are sometimes related, sometimes unrelated. We're here to share and commiserate, build community, and explore what we lose when we become parents, and also what we gain.
Welcome back to your favorite podcast, which, as you may have noticed, recently had a name change. We're now called Good Moms on Paper. We wanted to talk a little bit about why we're rebranding, changing our name. So the last episode that we recorded, which was the one with Rufy Thorpe, really clarified what our goals are with this podcast, what inspires us. We walked away from that conversation with her just really excited about what we're doing and what we realize this podcast is really about. So we thought of a new name, which took us like almost a full week. And here we are. We're Good Moms on Paper because we write, get it, on paper. But also, I was thinking all week long about how Rufy was talking about, well, I guess it was a Jodi Picoult quote, but how there are plastic balls and glass balls with both our parenting and with our creative work that we're juggling constantly. And the goal is not to drop a glass ball. It's okay to drop the plastic balls. It's okay to, you know, forget to send something to school with your kid or give them chicken nuggets 3 days in a row for dinner, but you don't want to, you know, forget them at school or not be there when they need you. And those same kinds of things apply to our creative lives. Rufy said something about, you know, maybe you can't do every single book club, but you don't miss your deadlines with your editor. So anyway, we're Good Moms on Paper. Sometimes we phone it in and let the kids watch Bluey, but also, you know, we love them. We write while they watch Bluey. My kid actually doesn't watch Bluey, but Annie just said hers does.
Leora has started watches so much Bluey that she started saying oos, like Australians do when they're happy. So when she gets something, and she also says oh biscuits for a swear word, because that's what they say.
I hope she develops a little Australian accent. I was reading that during the pandemic, kids were watching so much Peppa Pig that they started speaking in English accents, which I wish Louisa had been old enough to do at that point. But, you know, it is my goal for her to someday speak entirely in an English accent. So
I think British accents are much more irresistibly. One of my old roommates, her mom is British, and sometimes she would speak in a British accent and then I would speak in a British accent.
When I was in first and second grade, we lived in London for a couple of years. And when we moved there, my brother was one. We moved back and he was three and he had a British accent. I mean, he was the only one in the family. My parents said when I was around my friends, I kind of like sounded a little more British than when I was around them. But I mean, he was one. He just like learned to talk and he would say words that just cracked us up for a long time afterwards. Tessa, when Leela's older, you'll be able to choose what accent she has based on the media that you show her. It's going for.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm hoping for like kind of a creepy French accent, like an old Frenchman who's just like sort of hollering after people. I don't know what show I'll have to get her to watch for that, but I'll find it.
Ratatouille or something.
Speaking of British people, how are you enjoying Spare, Ellen?
I mean, I'm loving Spare. I cannot stop listening to it. I'm really resentful of the things that pull me away from this audiobook experience, which is like, honestly, really delightful. Prince Harry is a great reader. He sings an Elton John song at one point. He does like some really bad Australian and Scottish accents and actually American accents. You know, he like, it's fun to hear him drop some swears every once in a while. I'm really enjoying it. It's a great experience. I'm, you know, like a couple hours from the end. So within sight, it kind of felt like when I started, I was like 15 hours. I don't know, but it really has flown by. What about you, Annie?
Yeah, I'm also having a very good time with it. I mean, there is a lot of war stuff that you could probably skip. We can probably highlight which chapters to skip.
Kept texting each other like, less war, Harry.
So we are going to have our book club meeting. We'll have a book club episode that we'll be releasing shortly. Elle and I are both almost done with the book. Tessa doesn't have to read it, so she is just going to join us and heckle us. We'll release the episode, and we are trying to figure out, the book club is a very baby idea, so we're trying to figure out how to get people involved, how much even people, you listeners, want to be involved. For right now, we have settled on, we're going to do a Substack newsletter for a place to chat, and we'll also send you, like, you know, it also allow us to send you fun updates. We'll only do it monthly, so you don't worry about us spamming you. But if you want to join our newsletter for our newly branded podcast, Good Moms on Paper, the link will be in the show notes. And you should also follow us on Twitter and Instagram if you're not already. And it's always Good Moms on Paper.
And please, like, let us know if you have like a burning desire to, you know, talk to us about the book, or if you have things that you want us to talk about specifically in the episode about the book, like, drop us a line. We just love to hear from you and to know what you're interested in and what you want to hear us pontificate about.
Spare is our first one. We're going to do other books in the future that
are not jokes.
But this one's fun.
I know, although I am really enjoying this book, it, like, the idea to do Spare was sort of like, LOL, should we do it? And then we just did it. And now we're like, kind of liking it.
Yeah, it's great.
Actually, what I was saying to you guys right before we started recording was, I'm so impressed with the level of detail that the ghostwriter got from Harry. It seems to be just very common knowledge in all reviews and you know, media that I've read about this, that there's a ghostwriter, like, they keep naming him. It's not, I don't know why they're not keeping that under wraps more, but I want to know, like, did he live with him for 2 years and just ask him every single question he could think of? I mean, the level of detail about, like, you know, I don't even know, like, the flowers blooming and the swans at Frogmore Cottage and the sheets at Balmoral and all the, like, how hot it is at Sandringham and all these things. I'm just like, wow, you asked a lot of questions. All of
those words that you just said, I just, like, feel like I got transported into a Tolkien story, like Balmoral and Sand Goblin. Like, I cannot wait for this preposterous conversation that you guys are going to have about this preposterous book.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. Don't say too much more here. We'll save it.
But. Yeah, hopefully next week. I think next week, next episode.
Yeah, we'll be done by then.
Yeah, so this is our listener question episode, which we have been promising forever. Thank you guys for writing in. Please send us more listener questions, because we would love to continue to do these episodes. We are going to do more episodes that are just us three, so we can kind of dig into some of the stuff that we begin to talk about with guests, and also just, like, have a lot of fun. We are going to continue to have our great guests. So, but we're just going to mix it up with just us three sometimes. So we hope that is welcome.
We miss each other, so this is a chance to hang out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so
nice. So we've got a couple questions today, and our first one is a hard-hitting question. It came in a long time ago, so we have hinted at it at past podcasts. It's from Meryl. She is the mother of one child, age 2, and she wanted to know, I'd love to hear you three chat about where you're at regarding your decision to have one child or to have more. It's something I'm really struggling with, and I'd love to hear three thoughtful women talk about it.
Well, I don't know if you can get three thoughtful women, but you can get us. We have thoughts, actually, that are, like, across a pretty broad range here.
Yeah, we've got a good, yeah.
What's fascinating is that if you have listened to every episode of the podcast, you know that we already recorded this episode and the audio got messed up, so it's a lost episode, and I think our answers have changed and are evolved in the time since we first recorded it, which was months and months and months ago.
Yeah,
so who wants to open up and answer this hard one first?
Well, Annie and I have pretty different answers on this, and Tessa's sort of in the middle. So I feel like one of us should go. Do you want to go, Annie, or?
You go first. You go first. You're.
Okay. So I want two children, which is something that became clear to me kind of recently. And actually, I guess this is the time to tell everybody that that's actually going to happen sometime this year. I'm pregnant. I'm due this summer. Yeah, it's going to be a wild time. But I, you know, so I'm very clear now that I want two kids. But this summer when we were traveling, there were a lot of times when I felt such contentment and fulfillment looking out at like Justin and Louisa, thinking like, wow, this feels really good. Like having one child feels really good. Also, a couple times she got really sick this year. I was like, why would you have two children? I mean, there was like a stomach flu that I feel legitimately traumatized from. There was a COVID experience. There was like an air, you know, motion sickness experience. Anyway, so in the airplane. So I was sort of like, I don't know, one sick kid feels like plenty. But then we did an embryo transfer. We were lucky enough to have some leftover embryos from last time we did IVF, and it didn't work the first time we did it. And Justin and I had kind of thought like, well, we have one more that's tested, that's genetically tested. And if it works, great. And if not, like, we're really lucky to have one healthy, wonderful, you know, perfect child. So we did it. It did not work. And I felt devastated. I was so, so sad. I went to a really dark place. And I guess I just kind of paid attention to that feeling. Like, it clarified for me what I wanted, which was two kids. It was easy to, I think I must have like actually believed it would just work and be fine. So when it didn't work, I felt different than I thought I would feel. And that was like kind of a hard thing in our marriage, because we had made this pact that, you know, we weren't going to test any more embryos that we had. And then I was like, actually, I do want to test more. So we tested more. We transferred one. That one worked. So I am now in my second trimester, starting to slowly feel like, I don't know, I can make it. And yeah, we're having a baby this summer. So I'm firmly team two kids. And then I'm through. I'm closing up shop.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm so excited for you. Yeah, so I love knowing that, Ellen. And I'm very much in the middle about this question, although probably leaning a little bit more in the one kid camp than the more than one kid camp. And my reasons are many, although like really when it comes down to it, so much of it is really practical.
Yeah, totally.
Financially, it seems I'm like kind of overwhelmed by the idea of having two kids. I don't really know how we could swing it. Our life works right now in such a way with one that I can like have a lot of flexibility. And I don't think that would be true with two. We had to do IVF and we only got one embryo, and it was a true miracle that it turned into a child. Mm-hmm. Because my body did not respond well to IVF. And so we would have to start from round zero. And I think it seems really unlikely it would.
If I had to do the full thing again, I don't think I would.
Yeah. It was so brutal. Yeah. It was so brutal. We don't live near family or have family that can help. And there's just like a lot of ways in which I just like don't know in a really real logistical way how we would make it work. And I think that I have heard that to be true of plenty of friends and people in my life who are like, I don't know how I'm going to make it work. But then you just do, because you just, right, that's what you always do. So on the one hand, I do believe that we could figure it out if we had to, but I don't know. I think we probably won't. Every now and then I get a little like pang thinking about just like wanting Leela to have a sibling. That's really the main focus. And then occasionally I see a tiny baby and like have like some, it's like the last cry from my decrepit uterus being like, look at the tiny soft baby. And then that memory block of like what having a tiny baby is like, I think. So yeah, I don't know. My husband is pretty firmly in the one kid camp. So I would also have to pull some pretty neat magic over him to make him choose differently. But yeah. But like also just quickly as it relates to writing, I having, you know, a lot of friends with two young kids, I think that I feel a little bit intimidated by time loss from two little kids for writing, you know. And also, like, sometimes I try to zoom out a little bit and think, like, okay, so, you know, a couple years with less time sounds hard because, you know, every day feels hard in its own way, but really in the end, like, a couple of years of less writing time is not the end of the world. And so, you know, people do it, and there's so many amazing examples of women writers who had, like, buckets of kids, and it enriched their writing. So yeah, there I am on the fence.
Yeah, I think if I didn't have my mom in town being really willing to help, I mean, that is instrumental in the decision. So when you said that about not having family, I'm like, why would you do it? it's so impossible. And especially all of us are pandemic parents, you know, we just, like, we equate infancy, I think, and early toddlerhood with isolation, you know. I also, mm-hmm. like you, never look at a, well, you said you do sometimes look at a baby and feel a pang. I, like, don't have any stars in my eyes about newborns. I sort of feel like I'm doing this entirely for my child, and it's really impossible to imagine what it'll feel like to love another person the way I love her. You know, I think that's something that every parent feels, but it feels like it's entirely for her. And I know that that's not how it's ultimately going to feel, but it's like, wow, look at this major sacrifice I'm making for my already alive child by having another one. It's just different from the first one.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of the things that Tessa said, when we last recorded this podcast, I was, like, very much like, one and done, you know, don't even talk to me about having two kids. But I was also in, like, a much, let's just say, a darker place. I mean, it was before preschool started, and I just didn't have enough childcare. And I really associate a good chunk of her, the pandemic began when she was 8 months, and we didn't have any babysitting until she was two. And then we had some great babysitters, but we never had enough. And so there was a lot of, I just felt like I was clawing my way to keep my writing career alive. And I didn't have the option of just not writing because I had a deadline and a book coming out. So, that was a hard time, and I don't want to repeat it, but it would be a different time. I know that, but I also just, feel like now I have so much of my previous life back. I'm so happy generally, with a lot of things. And, my husband is also, Drew is like a, he works all the time. And so I'm, like, really the primary caregiver. And I just think if I was the primary caregiver, like, for two children, I would be, I just feel like I would just drown under that weight. And I think that I really read studies about, you know, moms who are the child of one, mothers who have only one child are the happiest. And I think that that's because, you know, generally mothers are the primary caregiver and don't have the support. My parents live 45 minutes away. They help. I mean, they're very involved, but I wouldn't say that they help. They're like, you know, we see them and we visit them a lot, but they're not, like, you know, they don't do any real babysitting. So I just feel like it would crush me. And so I just, I don't feel like it's, that would be, as much as I do feel a little bit of a pang of, like, oh, she won't have a sibling, which I don't even always think is a good thing when they're little children, because they don't really play, you know, but it's more like, when I'm dead and Drew is dead, she won't have another family member. But so I did say to Drew this week, cause we were talking about this, and I said, you know, I think one thing that might be important to me is by the time she gets to kindergarten, or, you know, at least first grade, if we could settle in one place and send her to the same school system until she's, you know, in high school, because what was so important to me when I was a kid is that I grew up with this same group of, they were all girls in our, and those friendships were so much more important to me than my brothers were, as much as I love my brothers. But I think it would be, so I think it would be hard if you were an only child who also moved around a lot. So that would be something that I would like to avoid, if possible, since, you know, we don't own a house. We both work from home, so we could, maybe be moving around. And I just think that's my way of finding balance and saying, okay, I'm gonna, so we are pretty committed to having only one child. But I think it's natural to have complicated feelings about it.
It sounds like all of us have complicated feelings about the choices that we feel like we have in front of us or have already made.
I had complicated feelings about having one. I mean, I both really wanted to have her. I mean, wanted it enough to like go through years of infertility and IVF, but also the whole time I was like, I don't know. Because, well, like many reasons, but one of the big ones was, in all of my years of like being in the writing community, the women I studied with in my MFA and my PhD, not a single one of them had kids, not a single one of them. And a few of the men sprinkled around did, but like they had all of them had great wives who, you know, did most of the child rearing. And so I felt really intimidated and like really stuck in that kind of false dichotomy, which is like either you are a serious writer or you can be a mother. And I think that, you know, I think there's lots of people in work that have kind of blown that open in many ways, but I do think it's also pretty easy to get stuck in that idea. And there's like stupid practical ways in which it's true. Like I keep being like, oh, the deadline for this is approaching, and I like look on the website and get excited, and then like, what am I kidding? I can't go like move to this place for 3 months to be seriously write this next book because like, I just have this little person back home. So yeah, I think it's complicated all the way through. And I mean, now being on the other side of it, like I feel like my life, and I mean, to poorly paraphrase Rufy Thorpe, who I guess we'll just talk about forever, like my understanding of humans and like relationships and complications is so much, for me, richer in this last year of having this baby. And so I mean, even just on this like selfish sort of art tip, I feel just so delighted to have her in my life. But all parts of it feel like they have complications.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, both Tessa and I did IVF, and it does, I mean, when you have so many failures and disappointments leading up to your baby, like I said, even with the second one, it clarifies a lot of things. Like to me, it made it clear, this is something that I'm really striving for and working for. I think if I, you know, were somebody who miraculously got pregnant from having sex, then, you know, I wouldn't have had to examine how much I wanted the thing, perhaps. Just knowing myself, you know, it's like you're just on the ride. But which I don't think is true for everyone who has a baby that way. But yeah, it's when you have to work really hard just to have the one, it is such a complicated thing, because I also felt a lot of guilt every time I would feel like, you know, unsure when I was pregnant, like, is this really going to ruin my, you know, my writing, or is this going to be really hard, like harder beyond what I can actually handle? And I feel like that with the second one, even, you know, like, is this going to be more than I can actually take on? And like, how could I feel like that when I paid all that money and went through all those hormones and all that disappointment for so many years to get here?
So we have another question. I think we hopefully answered that in a way that I don't know if it would help anyone, but that's our answers. So our next question is from a listener named Natalie. Hi all, mom of 3 and 1-year-old here, and I'm so grateful for your podcast. Like Katie Rundy mentioned, I'm in that phase of feeling like all I have is podcasts, and your show keeps me connected to my writerly self when my hands are full. My question: can you speak to your mental journey regarding childcare? This feels kind of embarrassing because it's privilege, but we technically do have money for it. Yet I've had a hard time justifying spending what I haven't earned when I haven't earned more than $50 for my work yet. Like I'm riding my, like as though I'm riding my husband's coattails. He's the breadwinner. It sounds like a lot of guests, for example, Claire Beams, felt confident paying for it. And I can't help but think, well, that's because they're real writers with published books earning money, so they're justified. I've published short stories and I'm finishing up a novel to query, so I don't feel like I have the credentials. P.S. Annie, were you talking about Allie Kazaza a couple episodes ago? Because I'm secretly obsessed with her stuff. Also LOL'd at the bumpkin thing. I was not talking about Allie. I don't know her, although I did look her up after I got this email. I was talking about the slob comes clean lady who her name is Dana K. White, and she's probably the number one celebrity I would like to meet. All right, childcare.
I think this is such a good question. And so, I mean, like another one that has a lot of, for me, like complicated feelings, because in some way, I feel like this is a question of identity and a question of like self-perception. And in order to make the choice to pay for someone else to take care of your children, you both have to, you know, believe that whatever it is you're doing on your own time is valuable, both in like monetarily, right? Because you're paying for the childcare, but also like that you just have to believe about yourself that you like, I don't know, deserve to have time where you're not with your children, and that your children will be fine and loved and taken care of, and like that you don't feel guilt about not being around them. So I do feel like there's a lot of facets of the identity here. But here's like the thing that I also think is so true about writing in particular. And that is the only way to get to the point where you are Claire Beams with your successful book is to put in the time to write the kick-ass book, to have it do well, to become successful. And so like that is just this basic truth. And like Rufy, I'm just going to talk about her forever, you know, sort of brought up the idea of the 10,000 hours again, which, you know, whether or not you believe explicitly in that idea, I think has a lot of truth to it, which is that it just takes a really long time to get good at writing. And so I think that if it's a thing that you feel really truly like this is a thing I want to do, this is a thing that I you know, I'm gonna put my time in, and you have the financial ability to do it, like hell yeah, get some childcare. You don't have to go, you know, balls to the walls 40 hours a week if that feels like too much, but I think paying for the time that in which you can take yourself seriously and do this thing that you want to do is the only way to even see if you ever can be at a point where, you know, you decide to call yourself a writer and you have this book or whatever. But like, you have to put in the time and you have to make that time. The time will not happen for you when you have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. It will not happen for you in any kind of normal life unless you carve it out.
I know my 2-year-old never just offers me an hour to write. She's never like, why don't I play quietly in my room? You go do what you need to do to take care of your problem. Okay, so I have a couple things to say about this. One is that I had Louisa in May 2020, so childcare did not feel like an option for a very long time. I also had, I'm super lucky at my job. You know, I teach at UC Santa Barbara, and we have very nice, generous, you know, modified family leave for like a year afterwards. So you teach a lot less. And anyway, I mean, I'm always like, it could be better, but it's pretty amazing. But I remember one of the things that really struck me was not to be the drunk aunt bringing up capitalism at the Thanksgiving table, but like how I read that book, Bringing Up Bebe. Did either one of you read that? It's like a New Yorker who moves to France and parents her children there. So, they have a pretty robust system of support for parents, including a creche, which is like the nursery that you can drop your baby off from pretty early on. I mean, also like you get also quite robust family leave, but you can drop your baby off at the creche. There's like apparently a long wait list. It's like hard to get into, but she got her kids in. And one thing that she said was so striking about the French parental attitude about this is that it was not just for example, like moms who are back at work. Like we think of childcare as being something that we have to earn or deserve, or like our time has to have value, sort of like just that can justify a childcare. And I just think that that's really, really cultural, because we have an expectation that there's going to be, that the mom has to sacrifice, that you either have to work or you have to raise your kids. And this, she had family leave still, dropped her kids off at the creche in Paris, and then like would go have lunch with her friends. And I just cannot fathom that feeling permissible in America. I mean, we just do not have that relationship with mothering in particular, but with parenting in general. And like, I encourage you as much as possible to just be French about it. Like, why do you have to add value? Like, why do you have to make money in order to earn some time to yourself? You also don't have to earn the time to yourself. Like, if you have the money to pay for it, and it feels like something you want to do, I just want you to remember that there are entire countries that would not think twice about that. So that's one thing, you know, like the lie of American capitalism and needing to earn time off. The other thing is, I had a friend who, when I was really dithering about when to send Louisa to daycare, how much daycare to pay for, it's been something that's been really gradual. We send her two mornings a week, and then three mornings a week. And now we're sending her every morning. And then next year she's going every day. And I had a friend who was like, teachers and, you know, caretakers at school are some of the very first adults out of many adults who will be raising your child with you. Like, this is the village. And it's really unfortunate that we live in a country where you have to pay for the village so much. But like, they're going to have coaches, they're going to have teachers, they're going to have, you know, their flute teachers, they're going to have like so many adults around them, shaping them, inspiring them, guiding them, supporting them, in ways that, like, you know, we can't even conceive of. Like, I think it's not limited what a mom can give a child, of course. I mean, not at all, but like, there's just a huge wide world out there. And I think it's really fun to think about all the things that other adults are teaching Louisa and, you know, getting her to think about, or she's like braver using the potty at school than she is at home. Like, there are just so many influences that I think are really exciting and can be a net positive. So that's me. What about you, Annie? You had a long journey.
That was a great answer. She does seem to want it in the question. It's clear that like she wants it. It's not, and she has written a novel, which is amazing. And I think that you can do it without daycare, but you might be a lot happier if you have daycare, and that happiness is worth a lot. And that's been my experience, is just that I don't know what our choices would have been without the pandemic. I made a decision to, I thought I was just gonna teach once a week when she was really little. So I did that, and then she rejected bottles. So even teaching once a week was horrible. And then the pandemic happened. So we're locked down at home, and I was writing at 3 a.m. and just, I was completely just nuts at that point. And then, so by the time that she got vaccinated and we felt that meant that, you know, preschool was an option, I had been like so worn down that it was just an enormous relief. This person has two children, and I don't know what her mental state is, whether she's worn down or not, but
she's full of energy.
I don't want to put words in her mouth that she's like just hanging on by a thread, but I would just say try it, you know, and see what it does to your mental health and your writing. I don't think it's a coincidence that I wasn't able to make real progress on my fiction writing until September, when she went to preschool. Before that, I was writing a lot of nonfiction and about parenting. And I was able to do that, the shorter stuff. But I think that, just like Rufy said last episode, that there is a lot, fiction requires a dream dream state a lot, like long extended periods of time alone. And so I wasn't able to get there when I didn't have adequate childcare. And she's also, she loves school. And so that makes it easy too. I know it's harder for littler kids who have more separation anxiety phases, but I think especially for 3 year olds, like they generally thrive, especially after a transition period. So it might be great to see. But yeah, I think you should try it if you can afford it.
I was going to say the same thing about kids loving school. Like sometimes it doesn't feel like enough to prioritize our happiness, but like if your kid loves it, then that can feel like it, you know, it's worth the cost, which is like, you know, sad that so many of us are measuring things that way. But yeah, Louisa has loved her little preschool that she's gone to since she was 18 months. And
you're also missing out on bumpkins. I mean, you're not doing bumpkins at home.
I mean, you get like the Christmas ornaments that they make for you. We got a mug with her handprint this year. I mean, you don't get any of that stuff if you're watching them all the time.
You know what happens when I pick Leela up from daycare? I come inside and she glances at me over her shoulder, sometimes smiles, but like keeps doing whatever she keeps playing. And all of the other children run at me with open arms, and I get this like dog pile of other babies who are so happy to see me, and my sassy little firecracker is just like, I'm sucking on this Lego, see you later. And it's really sweet with all the other babies, but anyway, she's having a good time.
Yeah, I think it also teaches them that you leave and that you come back. Like, I think that took a, you know, that took us all three of us some time to get used to drop off. And in fact, Justin has to do drop off, I mean, because it works for our schedules, but also because it's harder, I think, for her to say goodbye to me. Like mom has a soft touch and she'll know I'll sit with her and weep with her in my lap if she's weeping. But like, you know, she learns that she gets dropped off places and she always is picked up. Hmm. She's not abandoned.
Cool. Well, please write to us and let us know.
You're pro child care.
Yeah, we want to hear what your decision is. I think I'm very curious in your journey. So write to us so that we can stay updated.
Okay. I want this for you. I don't know if that helps you make a decision.
Yes, as your three friends who are in your ear, yeah, we want this for you.
Yeah, Natalie, and tell us how it goes.
Final question, which is more of a writing question. So write to us with your questions at goodmomsonpaper@gmail.com, your writing questions or your parenting questions or the overlap. This is our final question, and hopefully, and we'll do another one of these episodes in a couple of weeks. So this is our last question. Hi, I was wondering if you could talk on the podcast. Oh, this is from Erin, who was, she wrote our first ever fan mail a couple of, like in the beginning. So Erin's very special to us.
We love you, Erin.
Love you, Erin. I was wondering if you could talk on the podcast about surviving submission. As I enter into year two in this limbo, it feels cruelly so close and so far. After years of holding the power with querying, it is a mind screw to not have real contact with the people reading your work. Help.
Submission is the worst part of this all.
So in case someone is listening and doesn't know this, because this is a little bit of a mysterious part, I don't think I knew this before I actually went through it. Submission is after you get an agent and you query and get an agent, then your agent will send out to editors and you wait for the editors to respond, and hopefully one of them buys it. And that process is called submission. And
on submission,
nobody ever talks about them being on submission.
I don't know. It's super mysterious. And for some people, it's really, really fast. And some people, like poor sweet Erin, it's taking forever. And so number one, Erin, so sorry that you're in this marsh. How did you guys survive?
I always think back to, so I was on submission for a long time with Rabbit Cake. I got rejected by a lot of people who all are very sorry that they rejected me. but And I got some revise and resubmits. And one of those revise and resubmits, like when we resubmitted to her, she was on maternity leave. And then when she came back, she was like, I don't know how to edit and parent. So I can't even really like deal with this. So that was hard because it was like an almost, and it felt like we were building a relationship. And then it was, for personal reasons, I can't happen. So, but the thing that makes me laugh is I was on submission for a long time. And then when Ellen was on submission, she asked me advice of like, how did you get through this? And I was like, I don't know, it's fine. And then Ellen kind of angrily was like, well, I just pulled up some emails from you from that time. And you were like, you know, sorry, I haven't been talking to and like haven't been responding. I've just been in like, I've been in hell and I'm in the worst place. And, you know, what was me?
The problem with keeping friendships too long. I'm like, well, I have some receipts.
my advice is the hardest advice because I have a hard time doing this myself, but it's to write something else.
Yeah. Write something else. You know, do IVF. What else did I do? Go to Paris. I mean, all the high stakes, distracting things. No, not really. I mean, I'm talking about things that cost thousands of dollars, but just treat yourself like the tender baby you are. Like, read all of the books and watch all the shows that make you feel good. Don't challenge yourself. Like, only see people socially who don't cause you anxiety. Dissociate. What other advice do I have? I mean, it's awful. I remember writing a fan letter it was a blurb request, geez, to Melissa Phoebos. And she told me that when she was on submission, she like cried every day, you know, that she was on submission, which is not sustainable for, you know, months and months or even years.
Like if she says she's in year two of it, this is.
Yeah, like don't cry every day if you're in year two. But you know, like people who are successful and win NEA grants and, you know, are nominated for all the best awards, like, you know, cry when they're on submission. So I don't know that there's a way to get through it gracefully. It's just a really write something, distract yourself, like make yourself feel good, honor your feelings however you can and have to, but it is quite hard. You're not alone.
Yeah. And I think a thing that is hard to remember, really hard to remember in the moment of submission, well, a moment that can extend really far, is that you as a writer are not being judged. This is not like the trial in which Satan decides if you're a writer or not. I don't know why Satan gets that honor, but this is one project. This is one book that you've written. And so it, you know, not to take that lightly, like that's a big deal. It's so much work. We, you know, spend years doing that, but it isn't your entire writing life. It isn't your entire kind of identity as a writer. And so I think whatever else you can do to try to nurture your identity as a writer that isn't connected to the project that's on submission is fantastic. So if that's, like Annie said, like writing something else, if you have the capacity to do that, amazing. If that is, like Ellen was saying, like watching movies and reading books that, like, you know, twinkle up your little firelights and make you feel excited about writing or just reading and, you know, spending time doing that, fantastic. If it's like spending a bunch of days going on hikes or doing other kinds of work, you know, to support your future writing life, or, you know, allow your brain to be free and rested or whatever it is. But I think like spending a little bit of time to invest in yourself as a creative person who is greater than the individual project that's on submission is helpful.
You will publish a book. You will. Like you will. Yeah. We know you will.
Might not be this book. I mean, a lot of people go on submission and don't publish that book, and then they publish another book that is incredible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would just keep writing and try to put that project out of your mind, because now it's out of your control. So you have to just, you know, give it to the wind and hope that it works out. But it's not really helpful at this point to cry or obsess about it, because none of it's in your control anymore.
Yeah, it's up to the cruel gods of fate.
Mm-hmm. And so much of it is random.
It really is. You never know why people are saying no. And also, I mean, you don't always, if your agent's not sharing what the rejections are saying, you don't even know why, like, you don't even know the line that they're feeding your agent. Like, maybe there are some really close calls and actually it would feel kind of good to see them, but, you know, your agent's not sending them to you. So anyway, you don't know what's going on their side, and it's excruciating, and you are still a writer. Even if this book takes forever, even if this book never gets published, you'll publish a book. Keep in mind that Cheryl Strayed said your first book has a birthday. You just don't know what it is yet. Cheryl, come on the pod, Cheryl.
Cheryl,
we know you listen.
I actually think about Cheryl Strayed a lot. There was a, when we went to see her at Breadloaf and she was talking about how she wasted a lot of time, I think when her kids were in childcare and her husband would go to work, and then she was so kind of overwhelmed with the free time or scared to do the work or procrastinating, things we all do, that she would watch Toddlers and Tiaras all day. And then she would realize that her husband was like on the way home and she would scramble to like get some work done. I always want to talk to her about that, to be like, how did you get out of that? Because I always remember her saying that. And I think then the next part of the conversation was, and this is when I finally bucked up and started writing Wild, or I think she got Dear Sugar and then was able to really write. So sometimes it's like the side project that leads to.
It's true.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing in this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Our wild books are ahead of us.
But I mean, that is kind of, there is something to that, because you're a creative person with a lot of different ways of expressing that. And the book is one way. Like, here we all are, writers of books who need to stop thinking about our books, or at least just talk about our books in relation to how hard it is to write them when we have young kids and half a brain. But, you know, there are a lot of ways to express that creativity. So like, I remember being on submission with my first book, which was about ballet, and like going to a lot of dance classes during that time. I started taking hip hop, which I was terrible at, but it was fun and it distracted me for an hour and, you know, made weird muscles hurt. And anyway, there are a lot of ways to get through it without crying every day.
All right. We will be thinking of you.
Yeah. Let us know when it's published or something else is published.
Yeah. Give us the update, Erin, and we are cheering you from afar. We believe in you. We believe in what will happen.
I did just have a friend who was on submission for 2.5 years who just sold her memoir.
Oh,
I know. Amazing. To Counterpoint. It was great.
Yeah, it can take a really long time, and it also takes even longer than it used to. I don't remember how long I was on submission for, but it was a long time.
I was on submission for months.
Yeah, I feel like I was on submission longer than that, but I don't remember because I wiped that negative stuff out of my brain.
this is like having a newborn. You don't remember it.
But Ellen has the receipts, so if you need to see the emails.
Email me questions about Annie's submission.
Tessa got snatched up like a hot potato. Oh no, not a hot potato, a cold potato.
Hot piece of ass. But then my day is coming, don't worry, like it all shakes out in the end.
Well, that's what Ruthie said. Some people have really, you know, successful first things, and then the second thing is, I don't know, it's just it's weird, it's random. I take it all very personally.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, Annie, Ellen, it has been so delightful to talk to you as always. And Erin and Natalie and Meryl, thank you for these excellent questions. I hope that we did a decent job answering them, and we are really excited to answer more questions. So please write in anything that you want to hear us spin our brains around, which to me just still feels like so much Swiss cheese inside my head. But I love getting to think through this stuff with y'all. So thank you. We will be back next week. Until next time, we want you to know you're doing a good job.